Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, to what longtime political reporter Dan Balz learned when he talked to Trump voters in our neck of the woods. We know, living here in the Midwest, that the view from the coasts, particularly the East Coast, often doesn't capture the nuance and the dimension of our political views. Washington Post political reporter Dan Balz understands that well. His article, published in early May, begins with the voice of Austin, Minnesota voter Dennis Schminke, who voted for Mr. Trump and has become increasingly concerned with his choice. As Dan joins us, I think it would be valuable for both of us to hear from you this hour. If you're a Republican, independent, or Democrat who voted for the president, I want to know whether you feel as strongly committed to the president as you did then, on Election Day. How are you feeling about the way your party has reacted to Mr. Trump? Now, that's, again, for Republicans, independents, and Democrats who voted for the president, and some of the members of the Democratic Party who stand in opposition. So I want to hear how committed you feel to the president as a supporter on Election Day and how you feel about that now. And then for everyone, how you feel about the way your party has reacted to the president. Here's the phone number on this, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Dan Balz is an award-winning political reporter for The Washington Post. He's with us from Washington. Dan, I've been reading you for a long time. This is a real pleasure to have you on
the show.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Carrie. Nice to be with you.
I thought you and I could listen together to Cynthia in Buffalo. She's eager to get the conversation going, and let me go right to the phones. Hi, Cynthia. Thanks so much for waiting.
Oh, you're welcome. Hello.
Tell me what you're thinking about to the questions that I was asking about the president.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a veteran of our armed forces. I'm also a registered nurse, and I'm a Christian. I wasn't quite sure about Mr. Trump when I listened to all the election speeches and stuff initially, and it was definitely a prayer matter. But I did vote for him, and I'm glad I did. Now, I'm not saying he's perfect. He's a maverick. He's a rogue. We all knew that when he went in. He was a businessman at the time. He was not a politician, and he owned that. And his lifestyle might not have been the greatest, but that man has a spine. And that's what we need in this country, a president with backbone. I'm taking more money home in my paycheck now than I did. We've got our embassy in Jerusalem, and he is finally protecting Christians' rights for a change. And I'm all for him.
So it sounds like, Cynthia, if I may, your faith ended up being an important part of your decision and your continued support for the president, yes?
Yes. As I said, he isn't perfect. We all know that. He says some things that I don't agree with. But I support the job he's doing. I support him. And that's not an easy job for anybody.
I'm really grateful for the call. Cynthia, thank you so much. Dan, I want to know how that fits with many of the voters that you talked to in the Midwest recently.
I think it's quite typical of many of the people who voted for Donald Trump. And I was particularly struck by her saying that she wasn't quite sure at the beginning, but now she feels that this was the right vote for a lot of reasons, even though she doesn't see him as a perfect human being, which none of us is, or that things he does she disagrees with. I heard that a lot from people. There's a kind of category of voter that I found when I was traveling intermittently through the Midwest. And they are the people who were not sure what to do in 2016, but were attracted to Donald Trump for a variety of reasons, for many different reasons. And you know, there's no single reason. But they decided they would, in essence, take a chance. They felt things were not going well enough in Washington that perhaps a non-politician business person would be able to shake things up. And I think that there is a balancing that goes on with a lot of voters like that, which is they like the direction that, Trump is trying to move the country. They think he is trying to fulfill the promises he made as a candidate, even if he hasn't been successful in all of those. They're very happy about the state of the economy. And to the degree to which he says or does things that upset them or unnerve them, at this point, they're willing to put that aside because they think on balance he's doing the kinds of things that they wanted. So I would say that was typical of what I heard from many people who are Trump supporters.
Dan, just quickly, what did you make of Cynthia asserting pretty fervently that man has a spine? What do you read in how why that ends up being pretty important to her continued support?
I think many people regard politicians as generally spineless, that they blow with the wind, that they change their positions, in the face of any substantial opposition. And I think that many of these voters see Donald Trump differently. They see him as somebody who is a fighter and who doesn't back down from battles, and when he is challenged, tends to dig in. Now, that's obviously a trait that many people who are opponents of his find objectionable. But for Trump supporters, they like that. They believe that that he has given voice to many of the feelings that they have, and particularly in the Midwest. There's a sense that people on the coasts kind of look down on people in the Midwest or ignore them or, talk about the Midwest as flyover country. I grew up in the Midwest, so I have a sense of what that is like.
Well, we embrace the term flyover here, Dan. We even do a show called Flyover, so we're proud of that.
Well, as you know, some people find that a term of disrespect.
That's right. A couple of the words that you came back to a few times in the piece, which was lengthy, and we will post a link to anybody who hasn't had a chance to catch it yet. You use the words to say what a variety of voters were telling you, reassuring and exhausting. And does that go both to the policy and the personal behavior and this velocity of the news cycle around the president? What does that go to?
Well, let's start with the velocity of the news cycle, which I think has exhausted all of us. I mean, I know it has exhausted reporters who try to cover it. Our White House team is exhausted every day of the week just by the sheer volume of things that are coming our way. And I think a lot of citizens feel the same way. I mean, any number of people that I talk to, particularly once we got a year into the Trump presidency, said in one form or another, I'm watching cable news less or I'm paying a little less attention. As Dennis Schminke from Austin, Minnesota put it, I'm out of outrage. So I think that the sheer volume that the Trump presidency and the president himself pumps out all the time is exhausting. So I think that on the reassuring part, it's the flip side. It's what Cynthia was talking about, which is that for Trump supporters, despite the exhaustion of it, they like the direction he's pushing, and the degree to which he has not been successful in fulfilling those promises, I think they see other forces as mainly responsible rather than the president's lack of commitment or even lack of skill in trying to get it done.
Dan Balz is with us. If you've just tuned in, he's a longtime political reporter for The Washington Post, and as he says, has been making intermittent trips to the Midwest to talk to voters about where they were on Election Day, how they are viewing the path of the administration and the president's personal behavior, the achievements, the accomplishments, the things that the president said he would do and has not been able to deliver on. Wrote a big piece about this in May. And I've taken a lot of the information in that piece and turned it into a discussion, an ongoing discussion, the kind that we often have about where voters are and hearing your voices on this. So if you're a Republican, an independent, a Democrat who voted for the president, I'd like to hear, and I think Dan would too, if you feel as strongly committed to the president as you did on Election Day, And how are you feeling about the way the party that you're attached to, that you're committed to, is reacting to the president? I think that would be important, too, for part of our discussion. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, where Jeff says, I generally vote GOP, but I couldn't vote for Trump. My main concern was the tariffs, and now they appear to be going into effect, which was my fear. Other than his crazy tweets and tariffs, I've been happy with his policy positions. To the phones, to Pat in Minneapolis. Hi, Pat.
Even though I had donated a $30 check to the Sanders campaign, I did end up voting for Trump. And I know he's a knucklehead in a lot of ways, and I disagree with him on some stuff. And I this time I don't think I'll be able to vote for him again because I hear Sanders is going to run again. And there are a lot of other good people that are going to run against Trump. So he doesn't just have only Hillary as an opponent. And, I mean, it's going to be a whole new ball game. And I'm not hating on Trump, even though he's a goofball sometimes.
Pat, you're an interesting kind of voter, and I'll bet Dan ran into some other voters like you. It was either Sanders or Trump. You know, you would think there couldn't be two politicians more diametrically opposed, but maybe there's more in the middle that joins the two than we would think, and you found it.
Yes. Here's kind of how I would answer that. There are similarities in the messages of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, particularly during the campaign. If you think back to the campaign, Donald Trump was not a consistently conservative candidate. He had some conservative positions that he took, but he had other positions that were way outside of Republican orthodoxy. And particularly on kind of the trade issue and some economic policies, he and Sanders were pretty much in sync. I mean, both felt that many of the trade deals that the United States has made over the years have benefited the wealthy but not the working person. Mm-hmm. And I think both of them spoke to that. I think there was another element that brought people to Sanders or Trump that was similar, and that is a sense of authenticity, a sense of saying what they really thought. And we know that that was important in the Sanders vote, that the kinds of things he was talking about, people thought he genuinely believes that. This is not a message built by polls and focus groups. This is what Bernie Sanders believes. Trump also, in a different way, is somebody who speaks his mind. He says at any given moment what he thinks about things. In the end, I think there were some people who voted for Sanders, who ended up voting for Donald Trump. I think it's hard to quantify how many that is.
Right.
But I also think that the Sanders voters were not enamored with swinging and right away over to Hillary Clinton. And I think that that was a problem for her in the fall campaign.
Taslin says on Twitter, I didn't vote for the president, but I'm tired of profiles of Trump voters. I mean, the majority of Americans voted for Hillary. Let me grab a call on that as well, Dan, because there are questions coming in from our listeners like, why do we have to keep hearing about Trump voters? And I think you have a pretty good answer to that. To Adam in Red Wing. Adam, is that something you're curious about?
Very much so. I feel like we're coming up on 2 years on past the election, and think pieces where we constantly look at Trump voters like they're oddities in a cage and asking ourselves what were they thinking is just noise right now. We have a president who just said he's above the law, and this is not moving the country forward in any way. It's almost pointless.
I think Adam's got something when and we feel this in the Midwest, Dan, and I think you understand that, like, what happened to Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa? You know, who are these people? Let's go into the field and find out what makes these people tick. I hear Adam on this, but I also understand what the purpose is of trying to understand this. So tell me your thoughts on that.
Well, let me give some background to people about this project, which did not start out with the idea that we were going to spend 15 months going in and out of the Midwest intermittently to talk to people and produce 15,000 words that we would then, you know, ask our readers to wade through. This started with a very simple question, and it was in the days and weeks after the 2016 campaign, and that was what really happened and why. Because as we know, a lot of people got it wrong. A lot of people thought that Hillary Clinton was going to become the next president of the United States, and that when 60% of the people who voted on Election Day said they didn't think Donald Trump was qualified to be president, how did he end up as president? So it started out that way. For me, because I had grown up in a somewhat small town in Northwest Illinois, I said to one of my editors, I want to go back to where I grew up. I want to go back and talk to some of those people and just get a better idea of what happened. In the process of doing that and looking at a lot of data, we have some wonderful database people here at the Post, and one of them had put together a big spreadsheet. And in looking at that, I discovered that there were about 100 counties nationally that had voted at least 4 or 5 times, and in many cases more than that,
right,
for Democrats,
right,
for president, and then had flipped to Trump. And about half of them were in this region in the upper Midwest, eastern Iowa, northwest Illinois, southwest Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And in a sense, they kind of hugged the Mississippi River. And I thought, well, there's something interesting in this region, and I'm just going to go start to talk to people. Well, this continued on. My editor said, don't feel a need to write anything right away. I don't think he thought I would wait as long as I did. But one of the things that I found was that the longer I kept going and talking to people, the more this became a story of how the country, and particularly Trump voters, were absorbing the Trump presidency. And it was a sense of trying to say, okay, after 15 months, to what extent are people still with him? And to what extent are people moving away from him? And it was an effort to let people tell their own stories. It wasn't kind of like, an anthropological study. It was to sit down at length with people, and in some cases 3 or 4 times over the course of that period, and ask them to tell them how they were seeing things. Now, we're not doing this to the exclusion of everything else. I mean, we are covering everything else about the Trump presidency, but we thought that this was a way to let people tell the story of the Trump presidency in their own words.
And let me just, Adam, if you're still listening, and for other listeners who are asking, why do we have to keep diving into this? I want to reiterate that statistic that Dan brought up and publishes in this piece. Nearly 100 counties with a longtime track record of voting for Democratic presidential candidates, sometimes over 4 or 5 presidential elections, and then flipping to Trump. Nearly half of them here in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. Well, that's an interesting political question, and it's worth investigating, which is what Dan did and why we're talking about it.
Carrie, let me say one other thing about
sure.
it, and that is, in response to Adam's fair question, which is, it wasn't our intent to sort of say, what are these creatures like who voted for Donald Trump? And one of the things that I tried to do, and it did require the time, and in some ways required the length to which this piece runs, is to present people in 3 dimensions. This is not an effort to caricature Trump voters, whether they're still all in with him or a little bit uneasy, or whether they've given up on him, because nobody has, everybody has a different set of reasons why they are feeling the way they're feeling. And the piece, I think, again, because we tell it through the voices of these folks and you can see them over time either shifting a little bit or not, to try to give a fuller sense of how people think through these issues, because the entire country is galvanized around this presidency. We know that.
Dan, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because we talk a lot about, if you voted for Donald Trump, you are more than that vote. You are also a target for easy demonization in the kind of political conversation that we have today. And I think and that ethic that you brought to the piece, is, I think, showing us more of that dimension, right?
Yes. I mean, one of the things I learned as a political reporter here at the Post from David Broder, who was my mentor here as a political reporter, was that elections should belong to voters, not to candidates. Hmm. And the more we understand where voters are coming from and why, the better we understand why elections outcomes happen. And I think, you know, just speaking personally, I probably didn't spend as much time in 2016 doing the kind of quality interviews with voters that is necessary. And so one of the things I've tried to do in this piece is to, you know, is to go back and kind of redouble that effort. But you're right. I mean, and I think Trump voters that I talk to do feel as though they are often caricatured by opponents of Donald Trump, and they don't like that. They you know, it's like, you know, I'm a full person, and I had my reasons for voting for Donald Trump, but I have other views, and they may not agree with his. So it's that kind of thing. And as I say, the more you can tell a story like this, not by having experts explain who the Trump voters are or just simply using some poll numbers, but actually letting people talk, I think it's a valuable way for people to get a fuller understanding of what's going on.
Bud in Detroit Lakes called, says, "I'm a Democrat. I'm not surprised what Trump is doing. This is how he acted in the primaries. I'm disappointed with the Democrats that they keep blaming Trump instead of focusing on the whole Republican Party." This is an element of the discussion I want to get to with Dan as well. To the phones, to Dennis in Rochester, Minnesota. Hi, Dennis. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yes.
Give me a little bit of your story. You've been a union member for a long time. Is that right?
I've been a union member with the IBEW. I just got my 50-year pin.
Congrats.
I voted Democrat all my life. My family was always Democrat. We lived on a farm. But the only thing, I get tired of people telling me why I voted for Trump. And the main reason is, to me, the Democrats stand for three things that are our top priority. Number one is gay marriage, number two is abortion, and number three is illegal immigration. And I can't take that anymore. So
you switched from being a longtime Democratic voter to vote for President Trump on those three issues. Is that right?
Correct. That is correct.
Could I ask, did you vote for President Obama in either 2008 or 2012?
I didn't vote for Obama. I liked him. But he was pro-abortion again, and I think Obama was a great president, and the best thing about it was the first black that got elected in America, and I appreciated that. And I think that's why he got his pin there, because everybody was so happy that finally we elected a black president.
So, Dan, what do you hear? Dennis, thanks much. Dan, what do you hear in that?
I think that's a good succinct summation of one of the problems that the Democratic Party has, particularly in areas like the Midwest, particularly in areas outside of big cities. You know, I think Democrats have certainly lost touch to some extent with working class voters. We know that with white working class voters. And I think that they think that the economic message that they have talked about for many years is enough to attract those voters. But I think that the cultural and social issues that people see as being, you know, priorities of the Democratic Party don't sit well with voters like this. And it was a way that Trump was able to reach them. And I think that the issue of illegal immigration is not to be underestimated, that it was a subtext of a number of the conversations that I had while I was in the Midwest. And I think Trump spoke to that. I mean, I think the Trump message was a combination of kind of economic populism, particularly mm-hmm. on the issue of trade, which resonated with people, you know, who are in a place like where I grew up, Freeport, Illinois, which used to have a vibrant small manufacturing base, much of which has been decimated for a variety of reasons. But one of them is outsourcing and jobs going to China or Mexico. So that trade message resonated in those places. But the issue of Second Amendment rights also resonates in those kinds of communities. And the issue of immigration and kind of national identity is a very powerful message that Trump was able to seize on. Now, a lot of people who oppose him see that as kind of playing the race card, particularly the way he talked about Mexicans. But other people see the issue of secure borders and the combination of identity and terrorism all wrapped up in that, that spoke to many voters.
I think your discussion with Kurt Glaser from Sterling, Illinois, and is that a town that's fairly close to where you grew up, Dan?
It is, yeah. It's 50 miles or 40 miles south of Freeport, but also quite close to where my mother was born and raised, which was in Morrison, Illinois. So Kurt
tells you that Republicans have been, quote, almost discriminated against, and that President Trump addressed that as a candidate. And then he says to you, I very much dislike the fact that a lot of people stereotype Republican individuals, Republican people, that we're racist. And I was thinking, it reminded me, I don't know if you saw Peter Beinart's piece recently in which he warned liberals to stop using race to demonize Trump voters because it only pushes more, you know, people in the middle, independents and soft Democrats into Republican territory.
I think it's much too simple or simplistic to say that Donald Trump was elected by, you know, a group of racists.
A bunch of racists, yeah.
Yeah. I also think it is fair to say that race was an issue in this campaign. I mean, race is an enduring issue in American politics. We know that. And there are people, as we've seen in Charlottesville a year ago, or not quite a year ago, who have, in a sense, used the Trump presidency to become more emboldened to put those views forward. But somebody like Kurt Glaser, resents the fact that they are all painted with a broad brush. And Mr. Glaser was not the only person I talked to who brought that kind of thing up. So the idea that you can, again, caricature all Trump voters or put them in a box is unfair. But at the same time, we know that, you know, that racial politics is still a factor in the way some people, at least, come to these decisions.
Call here from John in Minneapolis. Hey, John. Hi.
Hi. How's it going? Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Good to have your voice on the discussion. What are you thinking about?
Well, I never voted Republican in my life, and I voted for Obama twice. And it was just really the whole globalization factor that the Clintons were very much into the whole globalization. It seemed like the Democrats are more concerned with what's going on in other countries than our country. And I really thought that Trump would be a good businessman and bring back some of the jobs home, especially, you know, manufacturing and clothes, retail, so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't get on the bandwagon with anybody else because I just feel like the globalization has just gone too far.
How is this looking to you now, John, given the controversy about the tariffs and some of the other economic policies?
I think it's a tough situation that we're in. But if we don't start doing something now, then where are we going to be in the future? So I think that we're going to have to suffer it out. Some people are going to have to take some losses until things mediate. But I mean, just an example, you go to the U of M and you want to buy some clothing. Every garment is made in China. Nothing against the Chinese, but when they can produce things on such a low cost level and flood economies, it really takes away the diversity of our own community. And I think that's very problematic.
Are you in manufacturing, John?
No, I'm actually a painter.
Okay.
And so that's another side is like, you know, I've had to compete with Mexicans, the South Americans, and they're great workers. We love them, but we want fair game. You know, I really blame the corporations, the big pharma, the big farms, you know, that have given work over and over throughout the last centuries to these people with no accountability. And now we've got a huge problem, 11.7 million immigrants here. And I'm not saying that they're a problem. I'm saying that there is a lot of problems that come with that type of movement and so forth.
Hey, really glad you were listening this morning. You had a chance to call. Thank you. Appreciate that. You know, as I was listening to that, Dan, I was thinking, what a visceral issue this tariffs and this global trade thing can be. Think about the almost unanimity of opinion among economists in Washington about what these tariffs, the consequences of these tariffs will be. And then listen to someone like John who says, hey, this was a top issue for me. And what those experts think does not change the way I, you know, experience this. What do you make of that?
Well, we're having a different conversation today about trade and globalization because of Donald Trump. And let me first say, I don't think we know how this is going to end. Until the 2016 campaign, the discussion about globalization was in general that, yes, there are winners and losers in all of these transactions, but on balance, this is good for all countries. And I think what Trump and Bernie Sanders and others, but Trump, because he seemed to have the biggest megaphone, what Trump was in essence saying was, in one way or another, we have not paid enough attention to the people who have been hurt by globalization. And that's a conversation that is valuable and one that was too easily kind of put aside by, you know, saying, well, we'll look for a better policy on job retraining or something like that. And yet nothing significant was ever really done about that. Now, the solution that Trump has, I think, is still I think it's an open question as to whether that is going to produce something materially different. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to, you know, we're not going to reverse globalization. We live in a global environment. The supply chains that big corporations use are multinational, and that's not easily undone or ever going to be undone. So the question is, what are ways in which you in one way or another mitigate the impact on individual workers, which can be substantial? And will Donald Trump's effort to impose tariffs actually improve things or possibly, at least in the short term, make things worse? I mean, there are a lot of farmers in the Midwest who are alarmed by what might happen to them as a result of this. So, in all of these things, there are winners and losers. And we're seeing in the trade war or the trade battles that are being set off, people who look at this and say, wait a minute, I could end up as a loser on this deal. So that's an open question. But the conversation is certainly different today, and that's probably good.
If you've just gotten in on the show, we are chewing over a piece that Dan Balls wrote for the Washington Post that is the result of a lot of reporting and intermittent trips out here to the Midwest. He talked to voters in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Illinois and Iowa. Did you also go to Iowa, Dan?
Oh, yes.
Or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to Iowa to take the pulse of voters that supported the president or didn't, but supported the president on Election Day, and what they're thinking about the commitment they made and what they see as they've watched this administration evolve. And I'm asking you some of the same questions Dan asked those voters. If you're a Republican, Democrat, Independent who voted for the president, it's interesting for us to hear whether you still feel strongly committed to the president as you did then. If you didn't vote for President Trump and you've watched the administration evolve, how are you feeling about it? And I'm also asking you, and I'm glad to get some answers on this, about how you think about the way your party, Republican or Democratic, is responding to the Trump administration. And I just want to say this. I'm hearing from a lot of men. That's great. I'd love to hear from you ladies if you're out there and you're listening to the conversation. We'll open some phone lines. Your voice really essential in this, too, as we've seen in some special elections here. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. and on Twitter, at @CarrieNPR, where Jonathan says, I voted Democrat for years. I voted for Trump. Still glad I did, with appropriate reservations. Don't need to agree with all of his positions. Dems push their social agenda too far. And then Brooke tweeted in to say, understanding Trump voters, they've given me a gift of understanding who they are, what they value, and the role they're willing to play in the erosion of our society norms and values. I know who my friends are now and what side they would be on if our democracy implodes. To the phones here to Jeff in Princeton. Hey, Jeff, hi. Tell me your political story.
Well, I'm a libertarian Republican, and Trump was my very last choice. He's an ignorant, arrogant, lying jerk, but I did vote for him, and I've been impressed.
Tell me why, really.
On all his major policy decisions, I mean, he shoots off his mouth and he blusters and says stupid things, but in the end, he has ended up making many of the right decisions that I'd have to agree with.
Okay. So I'm curious, Jeff, whether you are – Dan Balz and I talked about this at the beginning of the show. He found voters saying, I like the policies, I cringe with some of the personal behavior and the tweets, and I'm learning that I have to make some kind of a trade-off that doesn't feel all that comfortable with it. So are you in that space? How does that read to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we did get kind of tired of sending in nice guys and having them shot down. So, you know, I mean, he is a negotiator and a promoter. He's mm-hmm. very good at those two things. And I think those skills have proven very important.
Dan, what do you think? And Jeff, thanks.
Well, I mean, what I hear from Jeff is what I've heard from a number of people. A number of the folks I talked to said that Trump was not their first choice or second choice or even third choice during the Republican nominating process. You know, they may have been for Jeb Bush or Ted Cruz or Ben Carson or, you know, you name it, since there was such a big field. In the end, they decided to go with Trump. And there's a congresswoman, Democrat from Northwest Illinois named Sherry Bustos, and she describes voters like this. I won't say it's necessarily him, but voters who were fed up enough with politics as usual, with the usual kind of choices they got, that they were willing to take a chance on Trump. And
yeah,
she calls them
Trump triers, right?
Trump triers, which I thought was a very good description.
It is.
And I think that, there are people who are hardcore Trump supporters, were from almost the very beginning, still with him, totally loyal, the Trump core supporters. There are the Trump triers, and some of those are Republicans, some of those are independent, a few may be Democratic. And I think, in a sense, they hold the key to Trump's future. Assuming he runs again in 2020, he could be very difficult to beat. But he's going to have to be able to hold that constituency who supported him in states like, you know, Wisconsin and Minnesota and Michigan and Pennsylvania, those states that were very close. And part of the trade-off is, at what point, if ever, does the kind of the conduct and the behavior and the bluster and the disruption overwhelm the fact that people like things he's trying to do or believe that he's trying to keep his promises? And I think that kind of trade-off is what people weigh day to day, week to week, month to month. And part of it will obviously depend on who his opponent is in 2020, because it won't be Secretary Clinton, and that will make a difference.
You know what I was interested in when I read Sherry Bustos's categorization of Trump triers? I wonder how well you think the president himself understands those voters and cares about those voters. He reaches out to his base a lot, as all politicians do. Does he have a good read on the Trump triers, do you think?
I don't know the answer to that question, and I've never had a chance to talk to him about that. But I think that the president operates, as we know, viscerally, and his visceral instincts politically have served him quite well. And whenever he's criticized about things he does, I mean, he can rightfully say, look, none of you thought I was ever going to be elected president, and I'm in the Oval Office now. So he trusts his own instincts, and I think that he believes that in one way or another, he will be able to reach the people he needs to reach in enough places to be able to win re-election. But we're obviously, we're way premature in knowing, A, what the environment will be like in a 2020 presidential campaign, where the Mueller investigation is at this point, where the economy is at this point, the degree to which the kinds of things that he's set in motion have come to fruition, and how the Democrats respond, the degree to which they change at all in the way they, kind of try to combat President Trump.
Leslie says on Twitter, I hear your request for more women to speak up right now per Trump. I'd like to hear an entire hour devoted to the opposite of what I'm hearing right now. I don't think it's an accident that you're not hearing from women. Dan, I'm going to come back to that because, as I alluded to, there have been special elections where women voters, I think, in the suburbs have played a pretty important role. But I do want to hear from a woman voter here, to Pat in Deep Haven. Hi, Pat.
Thanks. Hi, Carrie.
Thanks for waiting. Tell me about yourself.
Well, I consider myself an independent voter. Uh-huh. Each election cycle, I look at the candidates and judge them personally, as mm-hmm. well as looking at the platform of the party. I will not vote for just one piece of the platform. I'm totally pro-life, but mm-hmm. it is not the only issue in our world today. So I can't just look at that and vote for the candidate who says they're pro-life, who might have not been pro-life in the past. But I am also an evangelical Christian, and I get lumped into you evangelical Christians elected Donald Trump. I didn't vote for him. Mm-hmm. I could never. My faith kept me from voting for him. Wholly immoral in his behavior, his speech, everything. And I know people in my church who didn't vote for him for the same reason. I think evangelical Christians are doing themselves a disservice to be used by political parties. They should stand up for what they believe in, their morals, their faith in God, and not decide that one party or the other is their party.
Okay.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah, good to have your voice in the discussion, Pat. I appreciate that. Dan, that's a different view than I think. There's been a lot of reporting about where evangelical Christians made a decision that President Trump's behavior was anathema to them, but they knew that he'd pursue policies that he'd support. Pat was not among them, I hear.
Yes, and I think, it was very interesting to hear from her because if you look at the evangelical community as a whole, they've been enormously supportive of the president. And I think part of the reason is, as you suggest, that their belief is that he is pushing for and instituting policies that they have long wanted. I mean, you can start with the nomination of Justice Gorsuch to the Supreme Court and other changes he's bringing to the courts, particularly the appellate courts. You can look at the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, which evangelical Christians applauded at the time he did it. Any number of things like that, issues of religious freedom. But there are some evangelical Christians that look at the side that Pat did, which is the behavior of this president, the allegations and things that he has done in his past, and say that's a bridge too far. It's interesting because people with, in a sense, similar sets of beliefs, whether it's Christians or union workers or however you want to define it, weigh all of these things differently because, you know, candidates have attributes and they have flaws. I mean, there's no perfect candidate. And so each individual voter makes their own decision based on the things that ultimately feel most important to them.
You know, I'm interested in how you factor in the role that suburban women voters played in some of these special elections, I think in Alabama and Virginia and Pennsylvania, with the voters that you were talking to here in the Midwest. What were women telling you about that, and how did it match up?
Well, a couple of points about that. One is that I was really not in suburban areas for this project, and deliberately so. I hope to do some more of that in the months ahead. I'll reiterate a point that you made earlier, which is as I write articles, and not just this article, but a lot of things. If there is anything in that article that is even vaguely critical of the president, I hear much more from men than I do from women. Mm. It's clear to me that the president's strongest supporters as a group are men. Now, that doesn't mean to say, and we've heard from folks this morning, that's not to say that there are not women who are strongly for Donald Trump and very happy that they voted for him. But I think that men are more, you know, as a group, I hear more from men and less from women. To the extent that I hear from women, it tends to be more people who are alarmed by Donald Trump and worried about him. And I think that we have seen that, as you mentioned, we saw it in the Virginia gubernatorial race. We saw it in the Alabama Senate race. We saw it in the Pennsylvania special election in the 18th district for the House, that suburban women, again, as a group, are energized in opposition to Donald Trump. And I think the big question for November is the degree to which they turn out in big numbers to vote for Democratic candidates.
Call here from Vicki in Duluth. Hey, Vicki, hi. Glad you called.
Hi.
What's your story?
Well, I could not vote for Trump, even though I do agree with some of the things. But I couldn't stand the man. Can't stand the man. I think he's just awful. So I couldn't vote for him. And I didn't like Hillary. I did not feel she was a good option at all. So I ended up voting Libertarian, which I'm not. And wow. But I did it, I have to say, with the idea in the back of my mind that Hillary was going to win for sure.
And so how do you feel about the choice?
Well, you know, honestly, I hate to be one of those hold your nose and vote, but I probably would have held my nose and voted for Hillary. Because I just don't like the man Trump. And it's really a shame because he could do something I really, really like. And I dislike him so much that it's hard for me to get past that.
So, Vicki, were you an Obama supporter for the two terms?
No, I really wasn't. I haven't really supported anybody. I consider myself an independent, and I haven't wholeheartedly supported anybody. But I think it's ironic that many people are looking at Obama, who didn't like him, and are looking at Bush, who didn't like him, and going, oh, we didn't appreciate what we had.
Good to have the call. Thanks much for that. You know, Dan, I did want to ask you about whether you'd seen the excerpts from this new book from Ben Rhodes, in which he quotes President Obama after the election as saying, what if we were wrong? Maybe we push too far. You know, as somebody who's done as much political reporting as you have, what's Obama really asking himself there?
Well, I think he's asking whether the policies that he pushed and the kinds of things he did with executive orders in his second term, in essence, stretched the electorate to a breaking point and pushed, in a sense, a progressive or liberal agenda farther than the country as a whole was prepared to go. And I think it's a fair question. I know that after the 2012 election, the president, I think, felt that in essence, resolved an argument that had been going on for 4 years about what direction the country wanted to go in. Ah. And I think he felt emboldened by that. And if you think back to the inaugural address that he gave in January of 2013, it was a very robust, progressive speech. And he outlined things and ideas and issues that he wanted to pursue, and he did pursue those in the second term. And I think that, as we've heard this morning, there were elements of that, particularly, I think, on the social and cultural front, that produced a backlash, and that Donald Trump was able to exploit that, frankly, to his own benefit and help win the election. And so I think that, you know, that President Obama and other Democrats probably are still asking that question. What's the right balance? How do you appeal both to the base of the Democratic Party and still attract and hold voters who are ambivalent about some elements of the Democratic platform?
And do you get the sense that Democrats have landed on an answer to that?
Far from it. I think that I think there's a considerable amount of debate, and I would expect that in 2019, starting in 2019, we will begin to see that debate play out as people begin to jockey for position to try to become the Democratic nominee in 2020.
I'm fully aware you're a busy man. I really appreciate an hour of your time, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
I will tweet out a link to Dan Balls' piece, the one that we've been talking about this hour, and you can look at it and chew it over and respond to it on Twitter. I'd love to know what you have to say. It's at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerry at K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.